Radiotopia.
I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Dear Diary.
Sixth grade.
February 14th.
1991.
I am really depressed.
How could she break up with me?
Mom, you can't read this.
I think about, you know, looking like a freak. And back then I was what people would call goth now. And, you know, I wore black and wore black lipstick and listened to Bauhaus. I was grumpy and antisocial. I had a chip on my shoulder at a very young age, I think.
From PRX and Radiotopia, this is the Mortified Podcast. I'm Neil. And today, the tale of a teenage outcast with dark eyeliner who transformed the word freak into something so empowering, it became her driving force well into adulthood. But back in high school, it was just something most people mistook as magic. Literally, magic.
A lot of people didn't mess with me because they really believed I was a witch. And I remember actually a cheerleader telling me that in high school once. And I didn't deny it because I thought it could work in my favor. So maybe they won't mess with me because of that, you know.
That's Amigo Badillo. And in San Antonio, where she grew up in the late 80s and early 90s, being a teenager dressed in all black could have a real downside.
During that time, there was a lot of fear of Satanism. It was a lot in the media. Like in eighth grade, I got on campus detention for being satanic. Because during the eighth grade panoramic picture, me and my friend, we crossed our arms over our chest, like, you know, in like a goth kind of pose, looking like really deep and dark. So we got called in the vice principal's office and had this whole spiel about Satanism. And this vice principal said that she had studied about Satanism and this was a huge sign. And my mom had to go and talk to her.
Amigo felt misunderstood by everyone in her school. But she didn't let that or her diminutive stature stand in her way. Here's Amigo on stage in Portland.
I was what the other kids called weird. Because I usually wore black and listened to the Smiths and loved art and hated all of them. So, but instead of laying low and trying to be ignored, I spoke out loudly and often. I guess I just wanted them to know that I wasn't scared of them and that I was totally aware of what they thought of me. Like in my 11th grade English class, we all submitted writing for this anthology that the teacher published and gave out to all of us as a memento, the end of the year kind of thing. So here's an example of what other people were writing. This is called Symbols of Red. Someone wrote this. It's a poem, and they typed it out in a heart shape, okay? What is red? Red is the smell of roses blooming in the spring. It is the sight of our flag waving so proudly on the 4th of July. Red is the school color that we so proudly cheer for. Red is the color of Christmas, celebrating the birth of Jesus. Yeah. So now here's what I wrote. This is for all the suckers who have been hassling me from the dawn of time. Yeah. For the past 3 school years, I've been at Taft High School. My journey through the halls of this prison have left me with a permanent sneer on my red lipstick face. Now, when these certain people look at me, most of them hate what they see, or at least wonder at me. Is it my problem that I don't want to be like them? All I know is that at least I'm very happy being who I am and not parading around like a god in a Letterman jacket with a beer in my hand, acting cool and making fun of the me's in the world. I would say some nasty and vulgar comments, but this is a school type assignment, so I can't. I usually do, but not in class. No, I do in class anyways. See, I know that deep down these people and I were carved from the same rock, and I accept that much about them. But the problem is that they don't realize that relation. At least I have some purpose in this place rather than being Miss Party USA. The reason I'm so weird, I think, is because I'm too soul-filled for them to comprehend. Here are some common myths about Emigo Badillo that I'm addressing to the people I've been affectionately writing about. Number one, she knows witchcraft. Well, maybe I do and maybe I don't. You'll just have to test me, right? Number two, she's really mean. Get her mad and she'll kill you. I get mad easily. Yeah, that's true. But that's because most people do the exact things that make me mad. All I know is that if you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. And if you're mean to me, I'll kill you. Number three. She worships the devil. That's a bunch of something I won't say. How can I believe in Satan when I don't even believe in his biggest competition? Well, right about now, those people are subconsciously hating me because my raging brainwaves just penetrated their minds. And I can live with that hatred because I've never expected anything from them. No love, care, friendship, conversation, or even a little high. They'll remember my name when they're in some stiff desk job with a life they hate, wasted on being a cool high schooler, when I'm in People magazine for painting murals on the White House walls with the president's permission. Then I spat in his face. So while I had that tougher, cynical side, I also wrote things that expressed another side. A side that mostly came out painting in my room listening to the Smiths. And yes, of course, it's poetry. This is a very personal poem to me. It's called Morrissey. The beautiful child, different from the others. Though he was a boy grown up in a day, a librarian was his goal. He had to take singing. He sings like a tapping spoon on a glass of wine. Making me cry is what he wants, all he wants. Don't eat your friends. Meat is murder. Cow, pig, turkey, fish. Why can't people settle with yogurt or cheese? Morrissey is everything. He will always fill my heart. So if I couldn't get the world to understand me through my awesome poetry, I could still tell them how lame they all were because I had a monthly column in the school newspaper. This meant I had a much wider audience to hear my rants.
I had it for a whole year, my whole senior year of high school. And it's so hilarious because that year, newspaper staff, the journalism teacher, she kind of didn't care about what we did. She was kind of like tuned out. So yeah, I had total freedom to just say whatever I wanted. So I wrote this little op-ed thing, and it was mostly about the terrible social structure of high school.
My column was called See What I See. And I wrote this the last month of my senior year. Now the real issue. What is my real issue anyway? I can yap about how it's all over. My high school existence is kaput, finished, bye-bye. Nah, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I want to just forget I had to write this. Forget I was ever here. Forget I ever spent 4 meaningless years here. It's not like I'll be remembered, and if I am, it might not be fondly. Sure, my teachers loved me, but that's because I brought a new light to their classes. I like doing that, but to most of my peers, I was just another weirdo. So you guys that envy the popular kids in this high school society need not worry, because you'll all be the same when you get out. You'll all be numbers. It'll be a shock to the cool guys, but they'll learn. They'll just have to join a frat or something. Just like high school, another closed-up world where you are the coolest on campus. As for yours truly, who knows? I could either disappear into the woods to live off the land as a naked huntress and talk to nature, or I'll end up in a one-room apartment studying for my finals, chewing on a loaf of moldy bread. Okay, so as you can imagine, my classmates never got it. They never got me at all. After high school, I moved out on my own and went in search of my place in the world. And unfortunately, I had to put aside my dreams of being a starving artist to become a drug addict. I know. Whoops. But you'll be happy to know that I didn't leave my classmates without a little encouragement. In my own way, of course. In the end of my newspaper column, I wrote, "Either way, I have a 50-50 chance of success in life. I'll do what makes me happy, and I suggest you do the same. Oh, why not? I wish everyone luck in life. You sure will need it." Thanks.
That was Amiko Badillo reading aloud her childhood writings with no embellishing, no exaggerating, just God-given awkwardness in Portland at the Someday Lounge. We caught up with Amiko in our postmortem, FIDE, and found out that in addition to being an outsider at school, Amiko often felt invisible at home.
My family life wasn't super stable, and I was the youngest of 3, and my parents fought a lot, and I feel like being the youngest and being the only girl, I was treated way differently than my brothers were. And I really, really resented my parents for that. By the time I kind of was like at the age to learn how to drive or learn certain grown-up life skills that other kids might be learning, my parents were kind of like too busy with each other to teach me. So I feel like I was kind of ignored a lot with stuff, and maybe a lot of that need for empowerment came in the form of me being this kind of person in school.
After graduation, Amiko set out to defy everyone in school and at home. And actually, her school newspaper columns turned out to be quite prophetic, just not in the way she planned.
I think I became the victim of my own writing, you know. I became the person that I was trying to warn people about. For as much as I thought I knew how it really is in the world, I fucked up, you know. I was a fuck up. I never wanted to do the things that were expected of me and what were expected of people in general in society. You know, you graduate, you go to college, that's normal and expected. So I ended up just, you know, moving out of my parents' house pretty much as soon as I turned 18 and moved in with some friends and just ended up doing a lot of drugs. It's pretty gnarly, the lifestyle. I had to go through a lot of life lessons.
So Amiko didn't end up a naked huntress that escaped into the woods, but she did find an escape.
Marijuana was always just a 24/7 kind of thing. But, you know, I got addicted to cocaine pretty heavily. That was my main bad addiction. But anything I was given, I would take. You know, I got into numerous different pills. I've pretty much done every drug there is besides meth. I smoked crack once, heroin. Yeah, pretty much name it. I think what allowed me to go down that far was, for as much as I thought I knew about the world and about people in life, I really didn't. But, you know, anything my parents were going to tell me growing up, I wasn't going to listen to. My parents tried to get me to move back home with them at one point because they were aware of my situation, not like the details of it. And a couple of my friends tried to have an intervention with me, but I wasn't ready.
Amiko's life went into a free fall. She was addicted and didn't always have the money to support her addiction. And bear with us here, because what happened to Amiko next is not easy to hear. And it's not something we usually share on this forum, but ultimately we're sharing because it's a part of Amiko's story of survival. Like so many other addicts, Amiko needed to hit her rock bottom.
I think the biggest wake-up call for me was when my drug dealer raped me. That was the lowest. And even after that, it took a couple years after that happened for me to realize what had happened, really. It's like it happened and it was there and I knew it was bad. But I think because I was so fucked up, it took a couple years for me to really realize how bad it was. That's the time when I decided to, you know, really go clean and start taking care of myself.
And once Amiko decided to get healthy, she didn't just cut out drugs.
I felt like I need to just cleanse myself altogether. And, you know, I just felt like going vegetarian would be another way to be clean.
Eventually, Amiko and her husband became vegan. It improved their lives so much that it became something both of them wanted to share with others. So, over a decade ago, they opened a vegan grocery store in the heart of Portland. They named it Food Fight, which is kind of perfect given Amiko's feisty underdog spirit. And in a fitting twist, the store has given her an opportunity to be outspoken about a new cause.
At the time we opened, no one really knew what it was. We wanted to show that being vegan wasn't all hippie food, and we wanted to show, like, no, you could eat really good, fun stuff and be vegan. I think, you know, there's different ways to be an outsider that are positive. And it's just natural for me to always be different, I guess. But now it's more constructive, I think. I'm always going to have these regrets of the things I did after high school, and as much therapy as I've had, I'm always going to have those regrets. But I do want to be someone in the world who might make a difference, you know? And especially considering all the hard times that I went through, I learned a lot. And I do know about the world after all of this. And I think I have a lot to share with people.
To share the shame, follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or visit getmortified.com to learn about Mortified stage shows, books, films, and beyond. Click participate, and who knows? Maybe you'll appear on a future episode of this series. As many of you know, the Mortified podcast is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, which is made possible with support from the Knight Foundation and MailChimp, who celebrate creativity, chaos, and teamwork. Our podcast production team for this episode includes Kathy Tu, Pierce Briselli, Dave Nadelberg, and myself, Neil Katcher. Egan Danahy, Megan Holmes, Susan Danahy, and Frank Matthews story produced this for the stage. Music by Gordon Bash, Alex Burke, Adam Smith, The Angel, Zoe Rose Palladino, and Snake Snake Snakes. Additional thanks to Lance Roberts Studios, Will Dwyer, Aparna Kumar, Tamar Abishay, Eric Bass, and all the dedicated Mortified live producers whose work make the stage show possible. Until next time, we remind you that we are freaks, we are fragile, and we all survived.